tucked into an area northeast of France and west of Germany, lies a land that, at least along the North Sea coast, is among the lowest places for elevation anywhere on the earth. In fact, if not for the historic industry of the land's inhabitants in building extensive seawalls or dikes, major portions of that land would be uninhabitable. In modern Europe, the land is divided on the map into the Kingdom of the Netherlands, the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, and Belgium. At the end of medieval times, though, the whole region was regarded as a single entity, and it was called, appropriately enough, the Low Countries. On any map of Europe, the strategic importance of the Low Countries can scarcely be overstated. The easy access to the sea, and at the same time to the interior of the continent, along with the close proximity to the coast of England, make it an inviting commercial highway and also an attractive military target. If you control the Low Countries, you have the key to the control of Germany and France and the base from which to threaten England and the countries of Scandinavia. For that reason, the Low Countries have been a battleground in nearly every European war for the last 500 years. There's been a lot of war in that area. The divisions which are reflected in the modern map were suppressed in the Middle Ages. But when the Romanist stranglehold was broken in the Low Countries, the Flemish people of Belgium and Luxembourg ended up being separated from the Dutch people of the nation now known as the Netherlands. In that land, large portions of the countryside are below sea level. And so to farm that land required the building of dikes and the pumping out, literally, of seawater from behind those dikes. Sometimes those dikes have become the targets of attacking powers. Some of them, for example, during the Second World War, were bombed by Allied bombers. And sometimes, as in the days of the Reformation, they were used by the defenders of the land to inundate their oppressors. In the turmoil of 16th and 17th century Europe, as the medieval political unity disintegrated and formed in its stead the modern system of national states. And just by the way, that is a step that is in the process of now being reversed through the European Union, eventually seeking to create a united Europe. And they are making rapid progress toward that goal. They have introduced a common currency, and they are seeking to make that currency the legal tender in every country in the Union, so that the Deutsche Mark, the French franc, the Italian lira, the British pound, and all of that, they are hoping will disappear entirely in place of what is called the euro. Well, as that unity of the Middle Ages disintegrated, the Netherlands came to occupy a prominent role in the advance of the ideas which are the legacy of the Protestant Reformation: representative government, liberty of conscience, and truly biblical theology. That legacy was transmitted to succeeding generations at a very high cost in terms of human suffering. And it is only when we appreciate the intensity of that which the Dutch Protestants endured for the sake of the truth that we can fully treasure the gospel heritage which they have conveyed to us. We have read this evening in the Revelation of Jesus Christ in the second chapter the letter that was written by the Lord to the church at Smyrna. Of all the seven letters recorded in chapters 2 and 3, none is full of more pathos and more commendation than the one written to the people in Smyrna. They were in a difficult place. Tribulation, Jesus told them, was about to break upon them. They were going to suffer an intense period of sacrifice as a result of their devotion to Christ and to His gospel. But the Lord's exhortation to them was very clear. Don't be afraid of any of those things that you're going to suffer. Why? Because there was a great promise that if they would be faithful, even unto death, He would give them a crown. And there would come not only that crown of life to them, but also the gratitude of all of those believers who would come after them. And so it would be for many of the hardy Dutch people, notably in the 16th century, many of whom would rather lay down their lives than resubmit to a pagan religion. We are this evening in the death to those people, and we don't know hardly any of their names. Oh, a few of the prominent leaders of the movement, their names have been recorded in various places, but many of the people who suffered and who died, as we shall see, were nameless to all but their own families and their own acquaintances. This evening, I want us to consider the basic progress of that revival of religion in the Netherlands, which we call the Reformation. And I want us, as we consider that progress, to ponder the frightful fury to which the Dutch Protestants deliberately exposed themselves in order that they might have the freedom to pattern their churches according to the Holy Scriptures. And to have the freedom to proclaim the gospel of salvation through the merits of Christ alone. So let us give attention this evening then to the Dutch Reformation. Now there is a powerful lesson that we must learn from the experience of the Dutch people. They made, in the 16th century, great sacrifices for the sake of the truth. But there is a great tragedy in Dutch history, in that those who came after them in later generations, especially in this 20th century, did not appreciate those sacrifices, and they abandoned that legacy, first for a mess of ecumenical pottage, and afterward for a society of open debauchery and defiance of the very things for which their forefathers expended so much blood. It was one of the great ironies of history that the organizational assembly of the World Council of Churches was held in Amsterdam in 1948. That meeting, of which it was said that it was the meeting that would set in motion a reversal of the trend that began at the Reformation. In Europe, at the end of the 20th century, Holland is the hotbed. It is the place where you go to practice every kind of perverted lifestyle, every kind of social experimentation, whether it's organized killing under the name of euthanasia, or whether it's the open flaunting of the sodomite lifestyle and the recognition of sodomite marriages, whatever it is, that is what you find in Holland now. And as I say, there's a powerful lesson to be learned. Let us beware, lest the sacrifices of previous generations in our own land be frittered away in a desire to have more comfort and more so-called unity. This nation is not immune to those temptations. In fact, it is proceeding down the very same road. As I said, we have some Dutch descendants tonight in our meeting, and they can testify better than anybody to what has been lost, not only in Holland, but in this country, over the last half century. Where the Reformation was once fondly remembered and its heritage gladly celebrated, now the Reformation is widely criticized. That's a huge mistake if it is not entirely forgotten. A half century ago, there was still a great wariness. Now, we're just talking about 1950. There was still a great wariness of the influence of Romanism in the public life of this nation. But now, the only wariness is of those who profess to believe what the Reformers taught and what they did, and who stick to the same Bible, which lay at the heart of the Reformers' preaching. Now, people are wary of them. Just 50 years. I tell you, that has not come about just by accident. This has been part of a concerted campaign to rehabilitate Romanism in the eyes of the populace. There used to be large public Reformation rallies every year in October. In city after city across the nation, there would be large gatherings where people would take their stand for the doctrines that the Reformers preached. But those rallies are now only a fading memory. Erasmus came from Holland, and also located in Holland were the schools of the Brethren of the Common Life. The Brethren of the Common Life were monks who had devoted themselves in an effort to reform the historically corrupt monasteries. They had devoted themselves to a quiet life of teaching and instruction. And there were many people who benefited from those schools. In fact, Martin Luther attended a school that was associated with the Brethren of the Common Life when he was growing up in Germany. They were located, of course, they began in Holland. And they were always a source of irritation to the Vatican. But the key influence in this area was a battle between Spain and England for domination of the new Europe that was emerging. The Tudor house in England had finally consolidated the throne, first under Henry VII and then under Henry VIII. And England was looking for great influence. Spain represented the old order of the Holy Roman Empire. It was a curious conglomeration of differing parts and sections of Europe, some of which were only loosely loyal to the emperor. The emperor at the time of the Reformation was Charles V. He was the king of Spain. And it was Charles V, at the age of 21, who sat in the emperor's chair at the Diet of Worms before which Luther appeared. And it was Charles V who declared Luther and his doctrines to be outlawed in the empire. Well, Charles had a very hard time. He never was really able to get all of his nobles to do his bidding. And that led to the assertion by many that the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was not much of an emperor at all. One emperor said that the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire was king of nobody, for nobody did his bidding. It was during his unhappy reign that the old order broke apart. The Reformation in Holland came about largely as a result of the struggle of the successor to Charles, Philip II, to regain the supremacy of the old order. In the early period of the Reformation in Holland, the movement proceeded somewhat quietly. Up until 1525, those who followed the Reformation ideas were largely Lutheran. And you can see why. The proximity to Germany, the frequent exchange of scholars between the two areas, Lutheranism began to exert an influence there. Also, the ready availability of Luther's writings made it certain that there would be influence there. The people were initially attracted to Luther's emphasis on the essential elements of the gospel, a free justification, that is, justification, salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone. That was Luther's message. And they were attracted to that message. And also, they were attracted to Luther's emphasis that it was the right of the common people, the ordinary lay people, not the priests and the monks, but it was the right of the common people to be able to read the Bible in their own language. And that was an idea that the church resisted furiously. In fact, there were many who were burned at the stake on that very proposition, that they believed it was important for the people to have the Bible in their own language. William Tyndale was burned in 1536 in the Low Countries, in Belgium, over that very issue. It was in Holland that the famous edition of the Greek New Testament, which Erasmus edited, first appeared in 1516. It was widely disseminated. It was printed. And so now it was possible for scholars widely to have access to the actual New Testament in the original language and to study it and to compare it. And it was Luther, as he used the Greek New Testament that Erasmus had produced and compared it to what the church taught, he found that the church taught many things that had no foundation at all in the Bible. The first Dutch translation of the New Testament was published in 1523. And it was when the Dutch people got the Bible in their own language. This shows you how God used the Bible in the days of the Reformation. When they got the Bible, when they could sit down and they could read it for themselves in their own language, they began to compare what they read to what they saw in the Roman church. And they said, these two things do not match up. And that prepared the way for a major movement to throw off the old Roman religion. Now, after 1525, there was a period of time in Holland where there was a very strong Anabaptist influence. For about 15 years, it was there that Menno Simons established a group, which later adopted his name, calling themselves Mennonites. And there were many other Anabaptist settlements that were scattered around Holland. Now, the problem with both of these movements was that neither of them appealed to the independent yet conservative spirit of the Dutch. Lutheranism emphasized the authority of the monarch. Now, that was a little too much for the independence of the Dutch. Anabaptism was perceived as being far too radical. Many of the Anabaptist sects advocated a throwing over of all government, indeed an institutionalizing of anarchism. And the Dutch perceived that as being too radical. Many of the Dutch were businessmen. They were engaged in commerce, in trade. And when they began to be exposed to the teachings of John Calvin about the year 1540, they found much to admire, not only in Calvin's theology, but also in his approach to church government, which with its emphasis upon Presbyterianism, upon representative government, the people electing their officers, and the officers representing them in deciding the policies of the church. And so from 1540 on, Calvinism began to gain a larger and larger following in Holland. And it was in particular the insistence of Calvinism on freedom from tyranny, which appealed to the independent desires of the Dutch. The real battle for the Reformation in Holland did not begin until the Roman Catholic reaction began to take hold throughout Europe. In fact, it is one of the interesting things about the history that Holland was the only land in Europe that was won for Protestantism after the Romanist Counter-Reformation got underway. By 1524, remember I said that in 1523 the Dutch New Testament was printed, published? By 1524, the Spanish rulers, and Spain had control of the Netherlands, they set in motion there the machinery of the Inquisition. The Inquisition was one of the most violent, repressive, vicious pieces of machinery and persecution ever dreamt up in history. In the Inquisition, if you were accused of being a heretic, you could not appear before the Inquisition tribunal and plead not guilty. That was not acceptable. If you were accused of being a heretic, you had two options. You could admit the charge and recant your heresy. This is whether you were actually guilty of it or not, according to them. Or you could not admit, or you could admit the charge and not recant your heresy. In either case, you were going to be either tortured and imprisoned, or tortured and imprisoned and put to death. That was the way the Inquisition proceeded. So that if someone, for example, had something against you, even if you were a faithful son of the church, all they had to do was to go to an officer of the Inquisition and say, I think I saw Lutheran literature in that person's possession. Or I think I heard that person discussing Lutheran doctrine with one of his house servants. And that would be enough for the officers of the Inquisition to order your arrest, to confiscate all of your property, and to put you into prison until you would be summoned to the tribunal where you would have those options. This is the way the Inquisition operated. And by the way, the Inquisition operated into the 19th century in Spain. So when the Pope earlier this year asked forgiveness for all of the excesses which some of the faithful sons of the church may have been guilty of in their zeal to be loyal to the church, you didn't hear him make any mention of the Inquisition, because the Inquisition was the actual arm of the church in motion. And so they set the Inquisition in motion in the Netherlands to try to root out these early manifestations of Protestantism. But it was not until 1555, when Philip II became king of Spain, that the policy to crush the Protestant movement in Holland began to flourish. Now, Philip was important because he married a daughter of Henry VIII. Of England. That daughter was Mary Tudor, who in the days of her reign as Queen of England was known as Bloody Mary. For she saw to it personally that over 300 English reformers were put to death in a period of 5 years. She was married to Philip, and she was a devoted Roman Catholic. She was the daughter of a Catholic princess, Catherine of Aragon. And it was her urging of Philip that led him on an effort not only to crush the Reformation in Europe, but also to seek to wipe it out in England. Now, Philip was a vain man, and like most vain men, largely irreligious. That is, there was nothing much spiritual about Philip. But he was devoutly Romanist. That is, he made sure he was at the Mass every day. He made sure that all of his court members attended Mass. But he himself, aside from that, paid little attention to any spiritual requirement. And he alternated between periods of gentle indulgence and savage cruelty. So that if gentle entreaties didn't work with the people of Holland, he then delivered the savage cruelty. In 1565... the nobles of Holland drafted a document which was called the Compromise of Breda. And that asked that the Inquisition be suspended. Now, this has been going on now for 40 years. For 40 years, the Inquisition's been operating in Holland. It asked that the laws against Protestants be suspended. And in that year and in the next year, Protestants began to rise up in armed revolt throughout the Low Countries. And in that time, hundreds of Roman Catholic churches were attacked and plundered. Philip's reaction to these developments was furious. He took a man who was the Duke of Alva and made him regent of the Low Countries in 1569 and ordered him to crush the Protestants. So Alva set up a special tribunal backed by 10,000 Spanish soldiers. And between 1567 and 1573, that tribunal executed about 2,000 people for no other crime than that they believed what we believe. By the end of the century, 40,000 Protestants had fled Holland to other countries. And some of them went to England, ironically, where they influenced the growing separatist movement there. And eventually, some of those separatists, after the turn of the 17th century, came to Holland and lived at Leiden for a while. And it was that group that furnished those who ultimately came to the New World in 1620 and founded the colony at Plymouth. So that's just to show you that there is a connection here, you see, between the people of Holland and the settlement of this country. These atrocities that the Duke of Alva committed were combined with an oppressive tax policy, so that any wealth the people had was immediately drained away from them. And in fact, the land stood in danger of being bankrupt. And much of the revenue that was taken away from the Dutch commerce, the Dutch businessmen, was taken either to Philip's court in Spain or found its way to the Vatican. Now, it appeared at this point of crisis that the Reformation was not going to survive. It was a time of trial. It was a time such as that of which we read in Revelation 2 and 10, tribulation. Intense difficulty. But what was the promise to the people in Smyrna? It will be for 10 days. It will be for a time. The faithfulness of the martyrs who were faithful even unto death was going to be rewarded. And that brings us to the third aspect of this story, and that is the liberation. There were what we may loosely call Dutch freedom fighters. They were led by a man named William from the House of Orange. He was also known as William the Silent. Now, in this period of history, there are a lot of Williams, and sometimes it's hard to keep them all straight. One was called William the Bald, and there were others. They were all known by some particular characteristic. I think we can assume that he was known as William the Silent because he didn't have much to say. He was from the House of Orange. Orange is an area there in the Netherlands. And it was from this area, later on, 100 years later on, that another William of Orange would go to London and there become the king of the United Kingdom, of England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland in the glorious revolution that brought an end to the Reformation battle there. Well, the revolt led by William the Silent did not meet with initial success. They were hopelessly outnumbered. The Spanish had tremendous military power. And the revolt that William led was doomed to failure, and so they withdrew into Germany. They took refuge in Germany. And it was during this time that the Dutch took to the seas. And since the Spanish conducted a lot of their commerce on the seas, the Dutch took to the seas and began to harass them. Began to attack Spanish vessels. Well, of course, this resistance did not meet with very great approval by the Spanish. And so the Duke of Alva launched a campaign of reducing one city after another. He would lay siege to a city, he would surround it, he would cut off all supplies to it, and he would force it to surrender. And when the city surrendered, he would march in and he would massacre huge numbers of the people who lived there. There was no trial, there was nothing like that. He just slaughtered them. Now, there was one city that thwarted one of these attacks when the residents somehow got to the dike and cut a slot in it, and the seawater came in and flooded the whole countryside around this city so that the Spanish troops could not get their horses into position to reduce it. In 1576, the city of Antwerp, which it was a major commercial center, was attacked, and 7,000 people were killed. This came to be known as the Spanish Fury. The Duke of Alva died during this time, but he had able successors. And this Spanish Fury came to be the thing that in the providence of God was the spark that aroused the spirit of the people in Holland and Zealand especially, the Flemish in other parts of the Low Countries, to drive the Spanish out of the land. And in 1579, the Dutch from the northern provinces signed the Union of Utrecht, and 2 years later they declared their independence from the King of Spain. Now, William the Silent, in this period of time, was helping to lay the foundations in Holland for a representative monarchy, that is, a constitutional monarchy like that which would emerge in England. But he did not live to see the fulfillment of his dreams. He himself was assassinated in 1584. 4 years later, the Spanish brought a huge armada of ships up into the English Channel. And it was the design of Philip to attack the English navy and to invade the island and to restore Romanism to its place of power. The English were hopelessly outnumbered, and their ships were small compared to the huge Spanish galleons. But when they came into the English Channel, the Spanish did not reckon on one thing. The English knew the channel. They knew where the shoals were, and they knew what the weather conditions were likely to be. The Spanish knew none of this, and when they got into the channel in such a position they could not get out, a storm came up and swept in through the channel. And in the midst of the storm, the smaller English vessels attacked the larger Spanish ships and sank them. And won really what was a miraculous victory. There's no way to explain it apart from the direct intervention of God. And that victory over the Spanish Armada, which took place not far from the coast of the Low Countries, that victory effectively ended the Spanish influence there and secured for the Dutch people the blessings of liberty, the blessings of the Reformation. That liberty was officially recognized in 1648 at the Treaty of Westphalia, which really ends the Reformation period. So there was a limit to what the people were going to be called on to suffer then. And as they suffered, they were suffering for the cause of Christ and His gospel. They would not have looked upon themselves as heroes. You understand that? They were not the prominent people. They were not in the spotlight. Many of these who gave their lives were simply people who had homes and families just like you do. But there came a time when they were called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice. But the Lord's promise was it will only be for a time. And there came a day when all the blood that was shed bore the rich harvest of gospel liberty. And then the epilogue. During the years that led up to the great defeat of the Spanish Armada, The Dutch had turned their attention as well to matters of church government and theological confessions. The Dutch Calvinists already adopted the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism as standards of the Reformed Church in Holland. They also founded a university in the city of Leiden in 1575, and part of the purpose for that was to provide a training ground for ministers to serve the Dutch Protestant churches. But the true battle for the soul of the Dutch Reformation and Dutch Protestantism was yet to unfold. Not from without. That battle was over. But from within, there was going to arise another great controversy in the early part of the 17th century. And that will be the subject of our message in the will of God next Lord's Day. But tonight, as we hear the words of Christ given to the people at Smyrna, we can rejoice not only in the faithfulness of the people in Smyrna, but in the faithfulness of many in the Low Countries in the 16th century who understood what the doctrine of the gospel was about. They understood what it was to have a gospel message which would proclaim to them that on the ground of the work of Christ, not on the ground of the Mass, not on the ground of penance, not on the ground of confession, not on the ground of anything, but on the ground of the work of Christ, they had liberty. They had true salvation. And they staked their lives on it. You see, it's something for us to sit here in comfort and say, yes, we believe that too. But if someone shows up with a spear or with a gun and asks you if you still believe it, that's when we find out. These people said, we stake our lives on it. If it means we die, we die. And many of them did. Many of them did. But staking their lives on the gospel, they could not fail. Even if they died, they could not fail. Because there awaited for them a crown of life. And not only that, but God would see to it that their sacrifice would not be in vain, but that succeeding generations would enter into the blessing of that gospel liberty. And it is as though they warn us from their places in time, from their graves. They warn us tonight not to take for granted that which has been given to us. It was given at great cost. Many people shed their blood so that we could live in liberty and enjoy the blessings of hearing the true gospel. So tonight, as we think of the Dutch Reformation, let us resolve that we will also stake our lives on this gospel, that we will indeed be faithful to it, whatever comes to the end, so that those who come after us may also benefit from that same liberty. It's a story over 400 years old, but it is a story that lives in our memory tonight because these were people who were bought by the blood of Jesus. They were our fellow brothers and sisters. They are members of the Church of Christ, and we are going to be joined together with them. They are among those saints who from their labors rest, who nobly fought of old, and won a crown of gold. May God indeed make us faithful in this time for the sake of the gospel of Jesus Christ.